You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Estate of Mind. A sprawling palazzo in the Eternal City has been both home and office to Giancarlo Giametti for decades, during and after his romance to his lifelong business partner, Valentino Garavani. The business half of the iconic house opens his doors to Vanity Fair by James Reginato, photographs by Simon Watson. Opening photo, Lucio Fontana's Concetta Spaziale, 1961, hangs in the 16th century painted salon of the Atelier, which was reimagined by Studio Perigali Sartori. And Giancarlo Giametti, photographed in his private offices on Via Condotti in March. It began on the Via Veneto, July 31st, 1960. On a warm Sunday night, the paparazzi were prowling the cafes, waiting to snap a screen goddess, or perhaps a dowager, principessa. The scene Federico Fellini immortalized when La Dolce Vita was released earlier that year. Giancarlo Giametti was an unlikely player in this decadent Roman mix. The 18-year-old architecture student's father owned an electronics store, but the shop was a block from the fashionable Café de Paris, which gave the elder Giametti, as well as his son, privileges to a regular table. Giancarlo was ensconced in his seat when Valentino Garavani walked in. The 28-year-old northern Italian already had a worldly air, having apprenticed in Paris with Jean Desaix, couturier to the Greek court and European nobility. Newly arrived in Rome, Garavani was launching his own label. He was incredibly seductive with his deep tan, blue eyes, and soft but intense way of speaking, Giametti wrote in his 2013 Assouline book, Private, Giancarlo Giametti. "Where can I find you?" Giametti asked after a short chat. "Via Condotti Undici," Garavani replied, giving Giametti the address of a Baroque 16th century palazzo where he had rented the second floor apartment to present his first collection. The year before, on a makeshift runway in a frescoed salon, he'd sent out 110 looks. Among them was an hourglass-shaped cocktail dress of draped tulle, bright as a poppy. The first dress Valentino ever produced in red. It was so delightful he gave it a name, Fiesta. By September, following a rendezvous in Capri, Garavani and Giametti were a couple. The rest is fashion history. With Giametti running the business side, Garavani became an international superstar. The Valentino brand established its headquarters in a sumptuous Renaissance palazzo at 22 Piazza Minelli, just around the corner from Via Condotti and the Spanish Steps, and the partners created outrageously extravagant homes for themselves on two continents. "They're so fancy, they put me to shame," Gianni Agnelli once said. After staging an epic three-day celebration in Rome in 2007, Garavani and Giametti bowed out of the business in a blaze of glory and chiffon, which director Matt Tiernauer captured in his hit 2008 documentary, Valentino, the Last Emperor. Now, under the creative direction of Alessandro Michel, the Valentino brand is majority owned by Maiula, a Qatari investment fund. In 2023, Kering acquired a 30% stake in a deal that gave it the option to buy the remaining 70% within 5 years. In retirement, Garavani and Giametti hardly faded away. Front row features at nearly every Valentino show, they entertained friends like Gwyneth Paltrow, Anne Hathaway, and Madonna at their homes and aboard the TM Blue One, their 152-foot superyacht. "There's nothing else like it," says Hathaway about the duo's world. "It's elegant, intentional, and elevated, yet relaxed, cozy, and fun. They are able to choose a lot of things that we think of as contradictory and make them complementary. I'm always amazed at how inspired and recharged I feel when I come away from my time with them." In 2016, the pair launched the Fondazione Valentino Garavani e Giancarlo Giametti, FVG, to support their charitable and cultural endeavors. Now, as they sail into their golden years, Vava turned 93 in May and Gigi is 83, they are about to unveil their legacy project, an international center for the arts, fashion, and culture, housed in a 10,800-square-foot palazzo next door to their old headquarters, which they have dubbed PM23, from its address in Piazza Mignanelli. Next photos, Valentino Garavani and Giametti, mid-flight in 2004. Portrait of Giametti, April 1970. Barbara Streisand with Giametti in New York, 1969. Giametti on vacation with Garavani in Saint-Tropez, France, in 1963. Garavani and Giametti in Capri, Italy, in 1968. The designer accompanied by Sophia Loren at a Valentino party in 1992. A runway model during the first Valentino show in the designer's atelier in 1959. Garavani, Giametti, and former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis in Capri in 1971. Elizabeth Taylor with Garavani in Paris. What's more, while Giametti was overseeing the renovation of that building, he acquired a lease on the second-floor apartment on the Via Condotti. Over the past decades, it had been occupied by Anna Bulgari Calissoni, a matriarch of the jewelry dynasty, members of which own the palazzo. LVMH, which acquired the majority stake in the Bulgari brand in 2011, operates its flagship boutique on the street level. A few years ago, Giametti heard that the elderly Calissoni had died. "I jumped on it," he recounts, referring to her apartment. In fact, he already had a stunning apartment on the fourth floor, which Peter Marino decorated for him. On the second floor, where frescoed walls, marble floors and beamed ceilings were still intact, Giametti envisioned a regal office where he could conduct business and entertain on behalf of the FVG. As reimagined by the Milan-based design firm Studio Perigali Sartori, it is now a space fit for a fashion monarch, as well as a showcase for Giametti's stellar collection of modern and contemporary art. Most recently, two monumental paintings by Anselm Kiefer, heavily layered with emulsion, shellac, coal, lead, and gold leaf, were hoisted upon the walls of the very salon where Fiesta made its debut. But don't call it an apartment. I was informed in writing by the FVG Communications Office that this publication must mandatorily refer to the location as the Presidency Offices of Fondazione Valentino Garavani and Giancarlo Giametti. Next photo, view of the painted salon on the Fondazione Valentino second floor. It's just a 3-minute walk from, acronymically, POFVGGG to PM23, where Garavani and Giametti have an even more famous landlord, the Pope. More specifically, the building has belonged to an arm of the Vatican known as the Sacred Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith, or Propaganda Fide, established by Pope Gregory XV in 1622. The organization was tasked with the transmission and dissemination of the faith throughout the whole world. It was the mother of all influencers. 23 Piazza Mignanelli was its printing house. Books, pamphlets, manifestos, and the like were produced here and shipped to people across the earth to make believers out of them. Garavani and Giametti are firm in their own beliefs. "Beauty has always been the value that has inspired us," they wrote in their mission statement for PM23. We believe it has the power to elevate, transform, and leave an indelible mark on people's lives. In addition to sponsoring a variety of educational activities aimed at incubating new design talent, they plan to hold two major exhibitions a year, spanning art, fashion, and education. For the inaugural show, entitled Horizons Red, they chose to explore their signature color. It was the easiest way to start, says Gemetti. According to Pamela Golbin, one of the show's two curators, this is the first exhibition focused on a single color, bridging the worlds of contemporary art and fashion. The clothes, all designed by Garavani, have been borrowed from his archives. Valentino was the only couturier to create a distinct oeuvre based on a single emblematic color, Valentino Red. His collections repeatedly featured a red silhouette, which evolved into his leitmotif par excellence, notes Golbin, previously head curator of the Department of Fashion and Textiles of the Musée des Arts Décoratifs in Paris. The designer himself puts it more simply, Valentino Red makes a woman very happy because she looks sensational, he has said. Alongside the gowns, the exhibition will feature 33 works of art created by European and American greats, including Picasso, Bacon, Rothko, Twombly, Warhol, and Basquiat. While a number of them belong to Gemetti, many are on loan from private and public collections. In the case of a 6x6 foot 1983 Basquiat oil, titled In This Case, Ownership is Transferred. Gemetti bought it in 2007 from the Gagosian Gallery and hung it in his New York City apartment. It is one of three large-scale skull paintings the artist created in the early 1980s, now considered a holy trinity in his oeuvre. In this case, the splattering of blood-red paint gives the skull demonic energy. Much as Gemetti loved the iconic picture, he sent it to auction at Christie's 4 years ago, where it fetched $93,105,000. I sold it to start our foundation, he explains. The identity of its current owner is unknown, though informed sources say it is reportedly Bernard Arnault. Whoever it is has graciously loaned it back to PM23 for the exhibition. Several of the most compelling paintings in the exhibition were created by Italian artists such as Lucio Fontana, Alberto Burri, and Algerio Boetti in the 1950s and 1960s, when, after the horrors as well as the drabness of the war years, artists were rediscovering red. Red was reborn in painting with an unmistakable new vitality, endowed with extraordinary energy and talent, says Anna Koliva, the show's other curator. According to Koliva, who was formerly the director of the Galleria Borghese, Garavani and artists of his time were tapping into the same vein, as it were. With his red, Garavani grasped the roots and effects of a momentous parallel transformation occurring in art. At this point in our lives, Valentino and I wanted to give something back, Gemetti explains to me about PM23 during a chat in Rome last winter. I didn't want to do a wax museum with clothes. We see too much of that. It's not just about clothes, be they beautiful, less beautiful. I wanted to do something more alive, he says. Beauty is not just about aesthetics, he adds. Beauty is about feelings. Beauty is about creation. There is something magic in the word beauty, especially in these times when things seem so ugly, so miserable. It's rather fitting that Gemetti lives upstairs from Bulgari, considering his close relationship with Elizabeth Taylor, who was a super fan of the jewelry house. The only word she knows in Italian is Bulgari, Richard Burton once quipped. Only a few months after Garavani and Gemetti met at Café de Paris, a well-connected friend of theirs talked up the fledgling designer to Taylor, who had arrived in Rome to begin production on Cleopatra. "Okay, let's see some clothes," said the star. As Gemetti recalls, Taylor arrived and liked something. "I need it for tomorrow night," she said, "for the premiere of Spartacus, the Kirk Douglas gladiator epic." Then came the deal. Elizabeth liked gifts, Giamatti explains. She said, if I get my picture taken in it, you give me the dress. Needless to say, she was photographed in it, and the House of Valentino got on the map. It was the start of a lifelong friendship between Taylor and the boys. As for the relationship between Garavani and Giamatti, it evolved over the decades. Their first 12 years, they spent nearly every day and night together. In 1972, they broke up romantically. Transforming our relationship into something new was a gradual process. But I soon realized that Valentino would always be family, Giamatti says. Our closeness, the way we needed each other, it was above everything else. It was stronger than whatever happened to us. What was most important was that we were always there for each other. We are there for each other. He's okay, says Giamatti about his partner's health today, but he's not walking well. That's why he's upset. That's why he doesn't want to see anybody. He doesn't want to be seen in a wheelchair. 2 years ago, when Mr. Giamatti contacted us about working on the Via Condotti project, I was a bit intimidated. He is a mythological figure, says Lara Sartori Rimini of Studio Perigali Sartori. She and her partner, Roberto Perigali, know something about mythological figures. They began their careers working for the revered Renzo Mongiardino, whose client list included the loftiest names in European society. Rothschild, Agnelli, Niarchos, and Brandolini Rada among them. Our master, as Rimini and Perigali still reverently refer to Mongiardino, also designed a villa on the Appia Antica in Rome for Garavani, where the designer still lives today, and a country house in Sitona, Italy, for Giamatti. Palazzo Maroselli Lepri, as the building on Via Condotti is named, was built around 1660. Rimini and Perigali, who have recently also been working with Marc Jacobs on the interiors of his Frank Lloyd Wright-designed house in Rye, New York, were delighted to find that the second floor retained much of its ancient Roman fittings. At the same time, the design duo sensed a narrative. It's a Roman love story, Rimini says, about Giamatti's life in the Eternal City, so it was important to me that we keep the Roman soul of the apartment. It was about restoring it, yet bringing in some contemporary atmosphere. While being really respectful of tradition, there is something amazingly rebellious about Giamatti's taste, says Hathaway. Hence, one finds, for example, Zaha Hadid's gleaming white and asymmetrical aqua table, 2006, which Giamatti uses as his desk. Above it is a black and red Calder mobile. Nearby, their study for portrait, an oil on canvas by Francis Bacon, untitled 14 Papers from Silverwood, an oil and colored pencil on paper by Cy Twombly, and a large untitled watercolor on paper by Kehinde Wiley. And then, an absolutely striking Basquiat from 1984, a skeletal figure painted in black acrylic on a white wooden door, one of the found objects on which Basquiat disseminated his defiant iconography. Next photos. Among Giamatti's collection of modern and contemporary works are monumental paintings by Anselm Kiefer, heavily layered constellations of shellac, coal, lead, and gold leaf, and the Fiesta dress from the first Valentino show in 1959. Looking at the Basquiat triggers another memory for Giamatti. In the early 1980s, the artist came to Rome with his girlfriend, the model Leslie Weiner, who was shooting an ad campaign for Valentino. The shoot took longer than planned. As Giamatti recollects, the model and the artist spent most of their time in Rome cavorting. One morning, according to Giamatti, the company's public relations director, Daniela Giardini, arrived at her office in Piazza Mignanelli to find Basquiat sprawled on the floor, asleep. Such storied lives on the global stage Giamatti and Garavani have led. Now it's all coming back to the very blocks where two young men had a vision and bet on themselves, as Hathaway puts it. During my visit in February, I ask Giametti to describe his emotions as he moves into the second floor on Via Condotti and prepares to open PM 23. "Listen, there is still so much work to be done right now," he responded. "I don't feel the emotions, just the stress." Whatever means necessary. After a dizzying rise in Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s MAHA movement, Callie Means has been a key leader of its federal health takeover. But former co-workers have questions about whether Means embellished the powerful narrative he rode to the top. By Catherine Aben. Opening illustration by Selena Pereira, which shows various key players with their photographs superimposed on a background with a snapping male hand. It sounds very woo-woo. In March 2024, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. crowded into a sweat lodge near Austin with about 40 other people, including a regenerative farming advocate and a nutritional supplement entrepreneur. "We were front to back, side to side. You couldn't move," Chase Iron Eyes, a Lakota legal activist, later recalled on a podcast. "I was like, man, I want to get out. I got to take a break. And then I was thinking, I'm the only Lakota in here. My whole nation's riding on me over here." He stayed in. The Sweat Lodge was the closing event of the American Wellness Summit, a one-day fundraiser for Kennedy's presidential campaign. Those in attendance had come in search of spiritual healing and cleansing renewal, yes, but also access to worldly power. And indeed, one of the people perspiring inside that jam-packed lodge was struck by a vision that would prove to have seismic repercussions for the health of every American. "It sounds very woo-woo," Callie Means, 39, told Joe Rogan 6 months later. "I just had this strong vision of Kennedy standing with Trump." A former wedding dress entrepreneur, Means had become a vocal proponent of ending chronic disease in America. Inspired by his epiphany inside the lodge and convinced that it represented the best path to implementing Kennedy's radical health care agenda, Means enlisted Tucker Carlson to help arrange a meeting between the candidates. On the night of July 13th, after the attempted assassination of Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, Means and Carlson made the fateful introduction. "There's rare moments in history when the deck can change," Means told Rogan, adding that he felt this could be a realignment of American politics. As Means described it, "The bond between the Republican fast food aficionado and the Democratic vaccine foe was emotional and instantaneous. They had weeks of conversations, and there was not a discussion of polling or the political horse race," Means said. "These were tear-filled conversations about why kids are getting so diabetic, about why we have such obese children in the United States, about why we have a fertility crisis." Leaked video of the two men talking by phone the day after the assassination attempt showed a less emotionally charged conversation. Trump could be heard wooing Kennedy and embracing his controversial theories. "Riffing on an allegedly excessive childhood vaccination," Trump said, "it looks like it's meant for a horse, not a 10-pound or 20-pound baby." In short order, Trump became president, Kennedy was sworn in as the nation's health secretary, and Callie Means became RFK Jr.'s right hand as a White House special government employee. In May, Trump nominated Means' sister, Casey Means, M.D., a one-time surgical resident whose rise in anti-establishment health circles has mirrored Callie's, to serve as Surgeon General. The Make America Healthy Again, MAHA movement, had been catapulted from the left and right fringes to center stage, with the Means siblings positioned as its framers-in-chief. Tall and wiry, with a patrician air and an often intense public demeanor, Callie Means paints a vivid portrait of endemic corruption plaguing the U.S. health system, a poisoned food supply, doctors and scientists with undisclosed conflicts of interest, revolving door bureaucrats, and out-of-control vaccine mandates. At the American Wellness Summit, he promised that the scourge of chronic diseases such as obesity and diabetes could be reversed very quickly once the corruption has been vanquished. And when the FDA announced a plan to phase out certain synthetic food dyes, Means was right there at the podium, extolling a major win of grassroots forces against special interest and declaring that the cries of MAHA moms are ringing out across the country. A wide array of medical experts have warned that the MAHA agenda and its slipshod implementation will potentially set the country's public health back years. Their plans, says George Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association, are not in line with the evidence and science that we know works. As a result, people will be getting sicker, showing up for medical care at a later stage of disease and at a higher cost. Means betrays no doubts about the righteousness of his cause. Like many MAGA-adjacent influencers, he seems to delight in slamming his ideological enemies. At a Politico healthcare summit on April 2nd, journalist Dasha Burns asked him about mass firings at U.S. health agencies. It's insane for you to insinuate that the thing standing between us and better health is more government bureaucrats, Means replied, before turning his wrath on the audience. The lobbyists in this room are laughing when we have the sickest children in the developed world. Given Means' dizzying rise from relative obscurity to the summit of America's federal health apparatus, his hyperconfidence may well be justified. That climb has been propelled by the personal story he has shared often, that he was a food and pharmaceutical lobbyist who saw firsthand the collusion of both industries with medical groups and academia. And yet, a six-month Vanity Fair investigation raises questions about whether Means has embellished his personal story. 9 of Means' former PR colleagues dispute some of his key biographical assertions. As well, his healthcare company, TrueMed, which helps patients use tax-free dollars to buy wellness products, is poised to benefit from the radical healthcare overhaul he has been championing. Vanity Fair interviewed more than 60 people for this account and reviewed 24 of Means' public appearances since 2023, his social media accounts, related federal and state legislation, and tax, lobbying, and business records. In May, Vanity Fair reached out to Means and presented him with an extensive list of questions for fact-checking and comment for this story. In response, Means said, "I stand by everything I've said," adding that he was not surprised that anonymous sources were spreading lies to Vanity Fair. Means, who is a special government employee, is not listed on the White House website as having obtained an ethics waiver. "He's managed to avoid the scrutiny of a full-time government employee," says Virginia Cantor, former associate counsel to Barack Obama and chief anti-corruption counsel at Democracy Defenders Fund, a nonprofit organization working to defend the rule of law. "Given his financial stake in health policy issues, I am not sure that an ethics official would have signed off on this in normal times. I helped funnel it." MAHA's would-be reformers are not wrong about the dismal record of our profit-driven healthcare system. About 1/4 of working-age Americans are underinsured and routinely skip unaffordable care or incur medical debt. Roughly 26 million people, about 8% of the population, have no health insurance at all. Prescription drugs cost almost 3 times as much here as they do in comparable countries. And life expectancy in the U.S. is about 4 years shorter than in other wealthy nations. Americans are so fed up that when a UnitedHealthcare executive was killed in cold blood on a Manhattan sidewalk last December, the mood in some corners of the internet was downright celebratory. Now, the MAHA movement is in charge. Its tent is big enough to include Berkeley granola heads and anti-vaxxers, fitness junkies and right-wing tech bros, and even COVID-19 deniers who allege the pandemic never occurred. A teeming marketplace of wellness grifters is along for the ride. While the movement's priorities range widely, from removing food dye from Fruit Loops on one end to amending the Constitution to prohibit medical mandates, including vaccinations, on the other, they are all certain of one thing. You can't just tighten the cables of our existing healthcare system. You need to blow up the bridge. In his 3 months in office, Kennedy has done just that. Hundreds of National Institutes of Health research studies on everything from cancer risk factors to adolescent diabetes have been axed. Gone are programs that tested milk for contaminants, shielded children from lead exposure, and decreased maternal mortality. Amid a raging measles epidemic, which claimed the lives of two unvaccinated children in West Texas, Kennedy has offered only tepid support for the safe, effective, and long-studied MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, which he recently claimed falsely on a News Nation panel has a lot of aborted fetus debris. Meanwhile, he has touted the healing benefits of vitamin A, the hype leading a number of Texas children to be hospitalized for toxic overexposure to the nutrient. At every step, Means has been cheerleading. In late March, when Kennedy's team forced out the FDA's top vaccine regulator, Peter Marks, MD, Means wrote on X that Marks was a mediocre scientist whose main expertise appears to be public relations and having lunch with pharmaceutical executives. When Kevin Hall, Ph.D., a top nutrition scientist at NIH, resigned in late April, Means, who has no formal medical, public health, scientific, or nutritional credentials, wrote on X, "Good riddance, Kevin." Means, who has claimed falsely that COVID-19 was a foodborne illness that did not kill metabolically healthy people, has faced criticism for his lack of traditional expertise. The arrogance of these bros, these professional podcasters who stand in front of career scientists and say, "What has science ever done?" Representative Jake Auchincloss, Democrat, Massachusetts, said at the Politico Healthcare Summit shortly after Means left the stage, "I don't know, science eradicated measles until 2 months ago." But Means has sought to shore up his credibility by leveraging a key credential. He says that as a former lobbyist, he witnessed and even participated in the corrupt backroom deal-making between pharmaceutical interest, big food, and the medical establishment. In a March 2024 appearance on Kennedy's podcast, he spoke with apparent insider knowledge of how Coca-Cola had lavished money on the very medical societies that should have been speaking out against soda consumption. "You wouldn't even believe this," he said, "but the American Diabetes Association took millions of dollars from Coke. I helped funnel it." That personal narrative of conversion contributed to vaulting the book he co-wrote with Casey Means, Good Energy, The Surprising Connection Between Metabolism and Limited Health, and Limitless Health, to the top of the bestseller list. Casey runs a health technology company called Levels, which helps customers track their blood glucose levels using continuous glucose monitors. She does not have an active medical license. With their Ivy League pedigrees and skyrocketing trajectories, the Means siblings have aroused suspicion among some of the Maha faithful. Some fear that they may be a part of a controlled opposition sent by the global elite to sabotage Kennedy's mission to smash the vaccine industrial complex. Means confronted two such critics on a heated episode of the Danny Jones podcast, a show dedicated to bringing fringe cultures to a wide audience. Defending his Maha street cred, Means said, "Seeing that darkness of corrupt deal-making has been foundational to who I am and what my story is." But former colleagues from his time at Mercury Public Affairs and Edelman, the two publicity firms that employed Means, say his work would not have put him in the meetings he's described. In some instances, the firms where he worked did not represent the clients whose meetings he says he staffed. His former mentor, Steve Schmidt, a longtime Republican strategist who brought Means into Mercury and oversaw his work there, then helped him land the job at Edelman, says, "Callie Means is not a whistleblower. He is an opportunist, peddling junk science to make millions. I saw inside the room. On January 2, 2023, Means made his social media debut as a big soda whistleblower. In a lengthy Twitter thread, he wrote, "Early in my career, I consulted for Coke to ensure sugar taxes failed and soda was included in food stamp funding. I say Coke's policies are evil because I saw inside the room." He went on to lay out the company's playbook. Koch gave millions to the NAACP and the Hispanic Federation, both directly and through front groups like the American Beverage Association. The civil rights groups, he said, in turn denounced soda restrictions as racist. He shared a 2013 New York Times article documenting the payments that flowed from the beverage industry to dozens of health advocacy and minority civil rights groups, enabling the defeat of soda regulations. He said the conversations he witnessed were depressingly transactional. It was just the kind of urgent insider stuff that breaks through the noise, and the tweet thread garnered 12.3 million views and 52,000 likes. Means offered even more vivid details on a podcast hosted by Drew Pirouette, a true med investor. "I was sitting in a room with the NAACP and Koch executives," Means said. "It was very unsettling. It was Koch executives telling the most prominent civil rights group in the United States, 'We're going to pay you millions of dollars, and we need you to call our opponents racist to shut down the debate.'" Means would later tell Joe Rogan that on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry, he helped steer money to academia to downplay the opioid crisis. Means explained to the fitness trainer Jillian Michaels on her podcast, Keeping It Real, that the food and pharma industries were my two big clients. I was a lobbyist and consultant. One of my big accounts was the American Beverage Association, which is the front group for Coke. Michaels had introduced him as the number one whistleblower in America. "I was completely mesmerized by his ability to tell the truth about the healthcare industry," Bonnie Hari, a nutrition blogger known online as Food Babe, recalls. "I had never seen anyone like him before do that in such a bold, truth-telling fashion. I extremely admired that." Hari has become a staunch ally of Means and a voluble proponent of the MAHA agenda, often appearing at Trump administration events. As his stature grew, Means received relatively little pushback. In 2023, however, the journalist Helena Botmiller-Evick, who covers the food industry in her Food Fix newsletter, asked him which consulting firm he was referencing in his big soda thread. Means declined to specify, she wrote. Means is not a whistleblower in the legally recognized sense. He didn't notify the authorities of any corporate wrongdoing or risk a job to divulge sensitive information. Many of the dealings he described were real, but they had been documented in the press long before he spoke out about them. In at least 8 public appearances identified by Vanity Fair, Means has said he had been a lobbyist. A review of U.S. lobbying records shows that he has never registered as one. In the 2 years since his viral tweet threat, he's been introduced as a former food lobbyist or Coca-Cola whistleblower in dozens of podcasts and presentations. Last August, he appeared with his sister on Tucker Carlson's show. As Carlson said to him, "You were a lobbyist, okay?" Means did not dispute the characterization and went on to describe how, as a junior employee, he attended a meeting where the food companies were paying off, you know, nutrition researchers at Harvard and Stanford. "So you saw that?" Carlson asked. "My first week, you know, working for these industries," Means replied. The episode became the most shared podcast of 2024, according to Apple rankings. The bigger his audience and the more Means spoke, the more bewildered his former colleagues at Mercury and Edelman say they became, as they recall the largely administrative work Means had done at Mercury and the more benign PR he'd been tasked with at Edelman. "I tried to scratch my brain and made a few calls to make sure I wasn't going crazy," says one former Mercury colleague. "Maybe there was a 6-month window when we all blacked out. This client came in, and Callie became the whisperer behind the scenes, plotting a supposedly nefarious role with soda executives." Callie means business. Means grew up down the street from the White House, as he said in a 2023 biographical video. His father, Grady, worked as an aide to Richard Nixon's health secretary, then led the Food and Nutrition Task Force to reform America's food stamp program under Gerald Ford. He went on to run PricewaterhouseCoopers' government consulting business. Means ran track and field at Georgetown Prep, then majored in political science at Stanford University, where he was president of the Kappa Sigma fraternity. He was drawn toward libertarianism, notably the idea that the free market should be protected from government intervention. As a rising junior in college, he interned at the Heritage Foundation and worked on a report whose language he used closely to his stance almost 20 years later. Congress should not consider any health care legislation that does not expand personal control over health care dollars, expand consumer choice and competition, and reduce the already excessive level of health care regulation, the 2006 report stated. His early resume, obtained by Vanity Fair, displays a penchant for hyperbole. He describes a 3-month White House internship at the Offices of Presidential Scheduling and Correspondence at age 19 as follows. Acted as liaison between the president and American soldiers in Iraq by analyzing and referring letters, emails, and comments from soldiers directly to the president. A separate bullet point notes that he was the youngest White House intern selected in 2005. On the 2008 John McCain presidential campaign, he became part of a pit crew working to help resuscitate the sinking reputation of vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. From there, he followed senior campaign advisor Steve Schmidt, who returned to Mercury Public Affairs, where he was a partner. In January 2009, at age 23, Means arrived at the company's Sacramento office. On LinkedIn, Means says he worked there as a director and describes his responsibilities as follows. Collaborated with team of lawyers and management consultants to advise companies facing high-profile public strategy challenges, clients in pharma, food, and energy spaces. In reality, Schmidt and other former Mercury employees say Means was his executive assistant. He was chiefly responsible for organizing Schmidt's travel, managing his schedule and expenses, and compiling his briefing notebooks. Schmidt has become an outspoken critic of the Republican Party under Trump and co-founded the Lincoln Project. He resigned from the board in 2021 during a period of turmoil sparked by another co-founder's sexual harassment scandal. Some colleagues recall him as a goofy frat boy who drank to excess at after-hours work events and once bought his office mates wearable Snuggie blankets. Others found him aloof with a blue blood vibe, as one former colleague put it. Schmitz recalls that he was once at a Starbucks at Ronald Reagan Airport, only to have his credit card declined. That led to his discovery that Means had failed to file more than $150,000 of Schmitz's expenses for reimbursement. That was his competency level as an assistant, Schmidt says. Still, Schmidt recalls him as thermonuclear smart and a bright young man in a hurry. Means definitely wanted to be in the strategic conversations, and that sometimes annoyed people, a former senior Mercury official recalls. He wore his smartness on his sleeve, like someone who wanted to matter. Though Mercury Public Affairs has registered lobbyists on its staff and is known to dabble in the dark arts of public persuasion, Means worked on the PR side, according to former co-workers. While he was there, Mercury represented a client that was trying to forestall a plastic bag ban in California. It did represent PHRMA, the pharmaceutical industry trade group, but mostly to help it gain access to the Obama White House so it could join negotiations over the Affordable Care Act, former Mercury officials say. From 2009 to 2011, when Means worked at Mercury, the firm did not represent Coca-Cola or its trade group, the American Beverage Association, a Mercury spokesperson confirms. In 2010, the Coca-Cola Foundation did donate $135,000 to the NAACP. But at the time, Mercury was actually working the other side of the issue, representing the California Endowment in its support of an additional tax on soda as a way to fight obesity. "We ran a campaign for them to get poor communities to stop drinking soda," one former Mercury official tells Vanity Fair. The effort was supported by California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, another Mercury client. In 2011, Schmidt helped Means land a job at Edelman in its Washington, D.C. office. There, old press releases show, Means helped Harvard Business School promote a roundtable on improving U.S. competitiveness and flacked for a company launching a wearable tech center in Silicon Valley. On weekends, when his parents were away, he threw memorable parties at their house. At the office, several colleagues recalled his air of self-importance. He seemed to have bigger and better plans ahead, which didn't include them. He walked around the office saying, "Cali means business," another former colleague recounts. Means's 2-year stint at Edelman ended in 2013. The Coca-Cola Foundation again gave the NAACP $130,000 in 2011 and another $150,000 in 2012, according to its tax filings. But Edelman represented Pepsi during this period and could not have represented its arch rival, say two of Means's former colleagues at the firm, who do not recall him working closely on food and beverage issues. During Means's tenure there, a spokesperson for Edelman says the company did not represent either the American Beverage Association or Coca-Cola in the U.S. A spokesperson for the American Beverage Association confirms it never employed Edelman. Coca-Cola was unable to respond by deadline. The NAACP did not respond to a request for comment. The American Beverage Association did fund a coalition that opposed soda restrictions during this time frame, but that group did not use Edelman to conduct PR, according to its tax filings and a former member of Edelman's leadership team who oversaw food and beverage accounts. The scenarios Means paints are highly unrealistic for another reason, says a former Edelman colleague. Had any money exchanged hands, the interactions would have included lawyers at each step, and only the highest-level folks in the room. The former colleague adds, a transaction like that at Edelman that would involve a junior associate is about as impossible or impractical an assertion that I could think of. When reached for comment for this story, Means initially referred Vanity Fair to a former colleague he described as his lieutenant to refute your bullshit smears. When contacted, the former colleague declined an interview, saying by text, "Cali shared the questions you sent over to him, and I did not work closely with him on those projects, so unfortunately can't provide any background." She was tearful about it. After Edelman, Means went on to Harvard Business School, where he met Leslie Voorhees, who already had considerable business experience and had managed a Nike factory in Jakarta, Indonesia. They married in 2016 in Portland, Oregon, and that same year launched a wedding dress startup called Anomaly that gave brides an affordable way to custom design their gowns. The dresses were made in China. Means framed the company as a consequential disruptor of the status quo. Fundamentally, the complete brokenness of the wedding dress industry has been an uncovered topic, he told a Forbes journalist in 2018. And there's going to be a time this year when every reporter in the country is writing about it in anticipation of all these bankruptcies. That never happened, and the couple sold Anomaly to David's Bridal for an undisclosed price in 2022. Their son was born that year, and they named him Rourke, after the conformity-busting protagonist of The Fountainhead. The inciting incident of Means Maha conversion had come a year earlier. In January 2021, Cali and Casey's mother, Gail Brown Means, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and died just a few weeks later. She was 71. It was a devastating loss, and it inspired them to take action, as Means told Joe Rogan last year. Casey and I, on her gravesite, literally hugged each other and said we wanted to write a book to raise awareness about the missed warning signs of poor health that led their mother to be chopped down by cancer. Casey had already embarked on a journey to understand the real reasons why people get sick, their book recounts. Good Energy presents a narrative of Casey Means' own journey from medical establishment wunderkind to prominent critic. In 2018, just months before completing her five-year residency in ear, nose, and throat surgery at Oregon Health and Science University, I walked into the chairman's office at OHSU and quit. The book describes her transformation from cog in a profit-driven sick care system with medical training that taught her nothing about the root causes of illness to a physician freed to have deep conversations with her patients to help restore and maintain good health. Paul W. Flint, M.D., who was chairman of the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at OHSU at the time, tells Vanity Fair that when Means left the program, it was because she found the surgical work too stressful and was not able to continue in the residency, even after taking a paid leave. Flint says that Means returned from leave saying, "I still can't do this." She was tearful about it. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.